And then along comes writing, and the word achieves a new status. And suddenly they invented this thing we call trivium. I said, well, wait a minute, there are now three words, three kinds of words. There's the spoken word, of course. And the medium of the spoken word used to be mimesis, this powerful technique whereby people were absolutely transformed by speech, by words. Not the minds. I mean, they were transformed. And Eric Avalakis spent a lot of time discussing and demonstrating precisely how this operated. The power of Homer and the poets resided in that oral word and was destroyed by Eric. But one kind of word was the spoken word. A second kind of word was the written word, this brand new thing. And the written word had different properties, and it gave rise to a new group of technicians called grammarians. The technicians of the spoken word were called rhetoricians, after the poets. And we have reduced rhetoric to simply a science of persuasion, but it's far more than that. It was far more than that, and again, it is now, today, far more than that. Grammar, however, the word comes from gramma, the old word, Greek word for letters, for writing. The Latin translation is litera, from which we get literature. A grammarian was a man of letters. The written word was the logos as buried in things. And the grammarian's job was to bring it out. The grammarian had two principal skills, etymology and exegesis, the science of words and the science of meanings. Its emphasis on etymology wasn't just an idea of history. Etymology was the science of the essences of words. And the essence of words traces itself back to experience. And experience comes from the encounter with things. So if you studied etymology properly, you would get into sense perception and into the essence of things. So grammar was also partly high science. Physics, chemistry, astronomy, you name it. It's part of grammar. It also had interpretation as one of its techniques. And the science of interpretation wasn't just that of figuring out what a sentence meant. That would be part of it. But multi-level interpretation, three, four, five, six levels of interpretation of a word or a statement or a sentence or a poem or an idea or a thing. Because the grammarian read two books and was subjected both books to his techniques. One was the written book, and the other was the book of nature, the book of the world, which also was considered the province of grammar. And he held the two books to be sort of parallel texts. So if you learn something in one, you could bring that knowledge over to the other and use it to learn more. The third science of words is dialectic. We have the word spoken, the word written, and the word in the mind, before speech. And this had several subsets. Action. One was logic, the science of correct thinking, and that gave rise to also to philosophy. Logic and philosophy constituted dialectic in the ancient world. These days it includes epistemology and a couple of other things, but still basically logic and philosophy. That's the trivium. So when somebody told Joyce, some of your puns are pretty trivial, that was a high compliment. The quadrivium is the remainder of the ancient educational system before science. The arts and the sciences, the arts were the trivium, arts of the word, and the sciences, different realizations, again, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, each of which was a language which could be translated into the others. So this is the trivium in the ancient world. Now, these were very much part of Marshall McLuhan's approach to things, and he didn't depart from these very far in any of his work. Part of my job this afternoon, I'm going to attempt to give a quick run through some of his work and discuss it in relation to what's going on today. His first published book is called The Mechanical Bride. It's a study of advertising and his rhetoric. Prior to television and the radio age, it was printed in the early 50s, 1951, and was remaindered before publication. So if you have a first edition, you've got something really rare. The book was actually never put on the bookstands. It was never sold to the public. It was printed, and I thought about a number of cases. These remaindered copies at 40 cents a copy, and passed them to students for his classes because he couldn't get them anywhere else. This was the study of advertising pre-TV. Later on, we wrote a book together called Culture's Our Business, which was a study of advertising after television. And both of them are rhetoric-based, and both of them focus heavily on the audience. And they include another technique, which I'll mention periodically, called practical criticism, which is also rhetoric-based. Next on the line, he had a book called The Gutenberg Galaxy. It came out in 1962. The Gutenberg Galaxy is the first study of the ground of a technology. The galaxy is the ground of the printed book, the printed alphabet. Not just a printed book, lots of printed books. Started in China, and many other books are now printed. But this is specifically the convergence of two technologies, printing press and the alphabet. And it has a very different effect from, let's say, the printing press and the Chinese character. Utterly different. This is a grammatical study. It's a reading of, or presentation of, the Book of Nature after the machine entered the garden. What happened to the garden? Next up was understanding media. I've already quibbled with the title on that. But understanding media was conceived as a toolbox, a box of tools that you can bring to bear. And this is the entire part one, things like the medium as the message, or the ideas of hot and cool, or media as translators, or reversal of the overheated medium, and so on. All of these are tools and processes common to all media, and these tools ought to enable you to pick up pretty much any technology, any time, and begin to deal with it, look at it. The Understanding Media was written as a companion book to one that someone else had written, Understanding Poetry, by Clarence Brooks and Robert Penn Warren. So Understanding Media is a bit like a book of poems. In the front you have the apparatus, and in the back you have all the poems. And in the back of Understanding Media Part 2, you have radio and TV and credit cards and roads and paper routes and clocks and so on. Those are the poems. Understanding Media is completely grammatical. Understanding Media and Understanding Poetry by Brooks and Warren were both based on practical criticism as a technique of study. And practical criticism includes the audience or the reader. It's not theory. It looks exactly at the reader and what happens to the reader as a result of this poem. What is the effect? So you bring that to bear on media. What happens to the user as a result of the telephone? Practical criticism. Also, Understanding Media and the Gutenberg Galaxy hammered away at the idea of the senses. He was beginning to bring together his work in literature and his work on media. practical criticism emphasizes how the sensibilities are rearranged by any encounter with the poem. Another book in this line is Cliché to Archetype, From Cliché to Archetype, which looked at the retrieval process. Any new situation brings back into play some old thing that's been sitting in the wings for a while. Sometimes that while is centuries or thousands of years, and sometimes it's only a few decades. on the fly leaf, it's a pity it never made it to be the later books without the dust cover, but on the flyleaf he gave away the basic principle, operating principle of that book, Cliché de l'Archétype. He had printed, new archetype is ye old cliché writ large. He had discovered that archetypes come. They don't just descend from the ether. They are actually old clichés that have been retrieved in a new ground. And right there, there is a few you can see right now, right around you. I'll save that. So let me get into this. We started at that point also working with figure and ground for the first time. Then he brought in a book, a study with Harlan Parker, called Space and Poetry and Painting. And this might be a kind of first ever text on comparative literacies. He's bringing one literacy or one mode of perception to bear on another. One medium as a way of looking at another. And it's always been true, if you don't really know your language until you know one other language. Pound said you can't know your own literature until you know the literature of at least one other country, one other culture. Then you have some way of estimating or gauging your own and its significance and its meaning. Same is true of languages, and the same, I propose, will be true of media. Space and Poetry and Painting focused on the senses and on, literally, the grammar of painting and the grammar of poetry. Not in the other sense of English grammar, parts of speech and syntax, but the grammar of the form. And it, too, is based on practical criticism. A little later, we wrote a book called War and Peace in the Global Village, which is very apropos right now. We're embroiled in a wide variety of wars and conflicts, and they're not pointless. One of the basic themes in War and Peace was that the function of violence of any kind is to create or to retrieve or refurbish an identity. It always has that function. Whatever else it does, it's often undertaken for that purpose. And you might see that in writ large in the newspapers any day of the week today. Just look at some of these acts of violence and ask about the identity component. And you'll begin to see just how large it is and how purposeful it is. War is closure for pre-existing situations. It's education, we pointed out in the book, in very high gear. An old phrase is the forcing house of war. When a country goes to war, its capacity to invent and come up with new schemes and new weapons and new procedures goes into very high gear immediately. War is education. Education, conversely, is a kind of warfare. And those two were two of the chapters in that book. It also introduced, I think, the idea of the discarnate, which was a big piece of McQuillan's work. We discovered that one of those obvious things, one of the side effects of electric technology, is that you don't go somewhere, and it doesn't come here, you simply are there. You pick up the phone, you are there. They are here, metaphysically. The body is sort of irrelevant to this new form of experience. It's there, but it doesn't have to be everywhere. You, however, can be everywhere. On the internet, when you go on the internet, my colleague Derek DeKirchhoff says, everybody on the World Wide Web is a node of the World Wide Web, de facto. The moment you go on the internet, you become the center of that universe. It's a universe with multiple centers and no periphery, no margins. And that's the medieval definition of God, by the way. Among many other things, it's also a very good definition of acoustic space. the speed of light, you are there. There's no movement anymore, it's simultaneous. And several other things happened at the speed of light, and these became the theme of a book called Take Today, The Excitement of His Dropout, which he wrote with Barry Neville. The three main effects of the speed of light: one is hardware yields to software. And Lamb's book about the economics of attention really has that one theme. He says it's a transition from stuff, hardware, stuff you can drop on your phone, to fluff, or style, ornament, decor, and all of a sudden with the senses completely. Hardware flips to software, centralism flips to decentralism, and that's the World Wide Web and the Internet, isn't it? And the telephone network, and a variety of other things. And jobs disappear in favor of role playing. This is the grammar of electric media. Finally, we wrote a book called Laws of Media, and this was in response to a challenge by a publisher who wanted to bring out a new edition of Understanding Media. I won't go into the whole story except to say that what we sent the publisher was it was different. We rethought the whole business and come up with four laws that seem to apply to every single human technology. And 30 years later, I can say, yeah, I think we were right. We still haven't found one exception. So, tentatively, I'll say there are just four laws. The book was another grammatical foray into the book of nature, the book of the world. It consisted of systematic essays on visual and acoustic space, which we talked about endlessly, but never actually sat down and said, okay, here it is, here's how it happens, here's what the proportions and the properties and dimensions are, and so on. It was at the time that we were working through those that Bruce happened in, and I had a very large manuscript, I think it was about 135 pages, for chapter one, and I said, here, take some, help me whack some of this out. Did you cut it in half? The book also went into detail on exactly how the alphabet works its way through our minds and our senses. It examined precisely how mimesis and the alphabet contended with each other. Havelock was most helpful in showing that Plato's War on the Poets over exactly this wound up being a war for individualized attention. We also had a chapter on the tetrad, and we discovered in writing the book that there is actually no difference whatever between hard human artifacts like microphones or books or stands and software, ideas. That all of the products of human activity are subject to exactly the same four. And the four laws of enlarging, obsolescing, retrieving, and reversal apply to all of them. These four are in a particular ratio, A is to B, C is to D. And precisely that ratio exists in all words. So we made the claim in the book that all of these technologies are kind of human utterance. They form a speech, and each of them has its language. I'm bringing in here the old French idea, structuralist idea of langue et parole. Langue et parole actually applied to the title of Understanding Media. The hardware of the medium, that is the car, the clock, the book, this is the parole, the individual word. But the penumbra, the environment that it brings into play, is the langue, the language that it speaks. Grammar of which we want to understand. We also discovered as we worked that two other people had worked in the field before us, quite aware of what they were doing, and nobody else knew it, which is quite a lot of fun. These were Francis Bacon and Giambattista Vico. Francis Bacon wrote a book called The Novum Organum, Novum Organum. He was going to do one better than Aristotle, who wrote the Organon, Aristotle's logic. So Bacon wrote the new Organon. And then about a century later, across the water, Giambattista Vico, a rhetorician by the way, wrote the new science, Scienza Nuova. And we consider those volume 1 and volume 2 and Laws of Media volume 3. So I subtitled it the new science. If I could go back and redo that, I'd call it the new science, call it Laws of Media, turn it around. Now, well, hindsight. Last, this book never got published during my father's lifetime. It was his doctoral dissertation. And it's just come out. It's called The Classical Trivium. And it gives, actually, the background for everything he did in literature and the arts and in media and culture and society. And it shows how they all have a common footing and a common foundation in grammar and rhetoric. Though he doesn't say as much. But if you can join the dots, which isn't too hard, you get it. Well, a moment about Tetrads.